Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. Jim, you have an interesting thesis in that you believe that the conflict that's being caused here in the 21st century is not based on ideology like a lot of the conflict was in the 20th century, but based upon corruption in several areas in the world.
Corruption has been a constant in causing unrest, you know, for centuries, bad government. But corruption is basically the primary form of bad government in so many countries today. I mean, everything else has been eliminated. You know, the old isms, fascism, socialism, you know, communism, whatever. These have all been discounted. There's general agreement, despite the, you know, the occasional burp, that a market economy is the most efficient, not the most perfect, but the most efficient. You know, it's like democracy. Churchill said it's first possible form of government, except for all the others. And that's what people have basically come to agree with a market economy. But the thing that makes a market economy not work is corruption. And this is what you see as a constant in all the, for example, the Arab Spring, all the Arab governments, the collapse of the Soviet, of the communist states, as it were, first in Eastern Europe in 89, and then the Soviet Union itself. The one common problem they all had was corruption. I've spoken to so many people from Eastern Europe, and it all comes down to there was nobody honest you could deal with. You had to pay bribes for everything. There was no trust. You couldn't depend upon, if you started a business, that some clown, either a gangster or somebody with more money or more lawyers, wouldn't come in and take it all from you. China, we're going to be doing a piece on this in Strategy Page in the next week or so, is in for a long, hot summer, and we've reported on this many times over the last decade. China has a huge problem with corruption, which they're aware of, but they cannot do much about because, again, as we pointed out with large countries, I use that quote that one of the, I forget which czar in the 19th century said, when, again, people were complaining to him about corruption. He says, look, I agree with you, but I don't run Russia. 10,000 clerks do. And this is a common situation in all these dysfunctional governments. Actually, you can't say it in the United States, although we have a federal system which makes some states more efficient than others, which creates a form of competition, you know, which improves matters. European countries have solved the problem to a large extent by institutionalizing basically clean government, which is unusual. But it's been one of the secrets of their success, even though they have a lot of other problems like overregulation, what have you. But at least it's honest regulation. In other words, people who have immigrated to Europe tell me that, you know, they know about how it works in America, and some of them do basically work in both America and in Europe. They say, Europe's not too bad. Yes, you're freer to do things in the United States, but in Europe, you know, just things are just more orderly and dependable. So maybe you cannot make as much money in Europe because of the high taxes, but it's okay. That's why people trying to escape from the corrupt countries, be it China or Middle East and what have you, they go to America or Europe, because from what they have heard, they are both much better than where they are. And the main reason is much less corruption. I mean, there are, Transparency International does this survey every year of the corruption index, as it were. And of course, the least corrupt countries, the United States, I think, is in the top 10 least corrupt, but not number one, which aggravates Americans. But then I tell them, all you got to do is think about it, you know, and that's a whole other issue. But they're all in Europe, you know, Japan, although Japan's fairly corrupt, Australia and what have you. But there's a correlation between countries that are prosperous and not inclined to rebel anytime soon, and lack of corruption. But yeah, in all the countries that you find that are blowing up in civil war and just uprisings, whatever, in Yugoslavia, it was corruption. And this has become the main cause, partially driven by the fact that because of nuclear weapons, the major powers are no longer rattling sabers at each other. They cannot afford to. They are still, thank God, let's hope that lasts for a while, afraid of nuclear weapons, except the one nuclear power you have to worry about is the most corrupt, and that's Pakistan.
Right.
And again, there's a correlation between instability and corruption, and Pakistan is one of the most corrupt countries on the planet, even according to Transparency International. So that's where that thesis comes from, and so far, unfortunately, it's proven all too true.
Well, and we've talked several times about the corruption problems in Afghanistan and how that mixed with the tribal issues there is that country's probably never going to be cleaned up in our
lifetime.
Well,
one of the reasons for corruption, I mean, that, you know, saying corruption is easy, but there are reasons for corruption. And one of the primary reasons for corruption is A, lack of civil society, which is something we in the West take for granted. For over centuries, we have developed a culture that basically praises people who are honest administrators, honest businessmen. Not that everybody is, but the general culture, you know, looks up to that and condemns. I mean, one thing foreigners find fascinating about America is we probably put more politicians in jail than the rest of the world combined. We take that for granted. But you talk to a foreigner and say, I can't believe how many and then, of course, there's this con guy, this French leader of the IMF who was going to run for, was likely to be the next president of France, put him in jail for coming on to a hotel maid. Incredible in the Europeans, but then Europeans who have been to America say, hey, that's what they do. If you're a politician in America and you get online, they will put you in jail. They will prosecute you. And that is rare, unfortunately. But it makes an enormous, you know, difference. Tribalism is a big problem in many parts of the world because there's never been what we call a central government, whether it's got a civil society attached to it or not. People need some kind of, you know, they yearn for some kind of dependable government. And a tribal organization gives it to you. Even if you're part of a larger entity, you can ignore them. As the Chinese like to say, the mountains are high and the emperor is far away. Well, that's what they say in southern China anyway. And that is another way of saying, look, we can decide things among ourselves. Simple things like divorces, property disputes and what have you, things that can turn into blood feuds and get very messy. No, get the tribal elders, you know, older people you respect, you know, that whatever honest people you can round up, and just come before them, and they're like a jury. They say, we'll decide, and you agree to abide by the decision. But tribal culture, tribal organization, means that the tribes are always at each other's throats. And this is something people miss in Afghanistan, unless they read strategy page regularly, is that in Afghanistan, you know, they talk about the Afghans hate foreigners. They hate foreign soldiers. Well, to an Afghan, a foreigner is somebody from another tribe. In fact, it can just be somebody from the next valley over who they never got along with. That's a foreigner. And bandits will prey on any foreigners, and of course most of the foreigners are usually Afghans. But that is a huge problem because when you have a national government, what happens is the person gets elected as the head of the government, and in the last 100 years that's meant they are the first ones to get their hands on any foreign aid or loans that, you know, the nation might make, and they immediately grab as much of that, steal it, as much as they can, and distribute it to other members of the tribe, because that's their power base. Now, this happens in the United States. A century ago, we had a clean government movement, actually late 19th century, because the spoil system was rampant. United States, as corrupt as it may be now, it was a lot more corrupt in the bad old days. And this is where the civil service exams. Of course, the civil service system became corrupt. I mean, all things do in time. But not as corrupt as what it replaced. And this is another example of the tribal system. The tribes are now organized around political parties or state party organizations, what have you. It's human nature. And in some parts of the world, the human nature is much worse than in others. And this is causes people eventually to take up arms. There's a lot more guns around these days, and to start killing, mainly for economic benefit. Freedom is an abstraction to most people. I have to remind people that all they have to do is look to their own ancestors. Why did they come to the United States? Not for freedom, for a job.
Right. Austin, your thoughts?
Well, I'm going to call attention to an article I wrote. It's in the On Point section. It's from June of last year, almost a year ago. It was titled, "Will Corruption Kill the Euro?" And all I'm going to do, if you folks listening to it can go back and look in the On Point archive for it, June 22nd, 2010, "Will Corruption Kill the Euro?" All it's going to do is add some specifics to what Jim had to say about the corruption around the world, but particularly though, here Jim was praising Europe, parts of Europe at least having a better record for transparency and honesty. Thing is, Transparency International, that Jim was referring to, I think these are the 2009 statistics, ranked two European countries, and it's near the bottom of their rankings, both Greece and Romania, which shouldn't surprise you, Balkans, were...
Yes, the Balkans in Eastern Europe are particularly bad.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Now, the focus of that column really was Greece's corruption in Greece. Notice that the member of the Eurozone closest to bankruptcy, and heavens, we're recording this on June 16th, headlines yesterday and today about Greece is even closer to default. Profligacy? Yes. Overweening social welfare spending? Yes. But the accelerator in Greece has been corruption, and the government also cooking the books to the European Union. Heck, the books are cooked at home, so they cook them for the European Union about what Greece's deficit was. Greece wasn't coming up anywhere close to that. What's the term, Jim, they use? The structural deficit that they are allowed to have. They're going to be members of the Eurozone. Is that the term?
But you know, one thing that's ironic about Greece is I followed this closely because it was a big issue down on Wall Street, is that when they were applying to get into the Eurozone, there was a lot of opposition, even, and we're going back a decade now.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Because they were notorious for their corruption, even in Roman times. But anyway. They were praised. They did, to a large extent, clean up their books, but they never lost the corruption because basically they pulled an enormous fraud on the European Union and a lot of other people, because basically nobody kept watching them. They thought, hey, the tiger's changed its spots, but they forgot that the spots can come back.
Look, the way that it was put, and I'm paraphrasing something from that article. I just went and brought the article up here on my laptop, is that there was a failure of its systems for monitoring. Boy, does that sound like bureaucratic speak. I'm talking about the EU system, for failure to monitor it, but that the Greek government's actual deficit was twice as high as officially reported, violated every one of the fiscal agreements. The Greeks essentially borrowed money they couldn't repay, and that's part of why they are where they are. Now, I went through the Transparency International business. I mentioned that a second ago, and it was Greece and Romania tied for 71st on that Transparency International study. But there was more to it, and I'm going to put this in that particular column. 13% of Greek households reported that in the year of 2008 they paid a bribe. $950 million estimated to public and private bribe takers. And that was a study done by Transparency international. Now, go ahead, and I'm going to read part of this. Reuters cited a Greek poll taken in early June, that would have been last year, 2010, which found that 78% of the Greek people accept, quote, accept the view that many or all in government are corrupt, unquote. FoxBusiness.com reported Greece's finance ministry had discovered a rampant tax evasion and corruption scheme, including bribery, in its own tax collection offices. The finance ministry announced that it was investigating some 70 government officials who make about $62,000 a year on average, but own anywhere from $982,000 to $3.7 million in real estate. Greek tax evaders cost the country $27 billion a year. Now, and then last month, and this was in May of 2010, the European Union International Monetary Fund had loaned Greece $120 billion. Now, think about that. So that's 30. In other words, they got loaned 4 years' worth of taxes that were evaded inside Greece. If my big point here, and this is taking on a comparatively advanced country, heaven. It's Greece is a member of NATO, member of the European Union. It's not Africa, sub-Saharan Africa. It's not the Middle East. It's not South America. It is tied to some of the most advanced economies in the world, Germany and France. And the corruption is one of the chief drivers in this entire fiasco, the Greek fiasco that threatens the Eurozone and potentially the entire political makeup of the European Union. And this is a build off of what Jim was saying about really cultures of corruption. Look at the effects inside Europe right now and globally because of the corruption in Greece. Also, failure on the part of the European Union to discipline their own economic system. There's a kind of neglect there, not necessarily crooked. Not necessarily, don't know the facts on it, not necessarily crooked, but it is a neglect. And it proves to be not a benign neglect, but a very damaging neglect that Greece was not required, was not investigated, not held to meet the responsibilities that they had agreed to when they joined the European Union, joined the Eurozone, and of course the absolute violation was lying about it. This is a huge price, Dan. It's a huge price not just to Greece and the European Union, but the entire world because of the recession that it exacerbates the global recession. Now, does this turn into a war? Let's take a look at Greece inside. And we've written about this on Strategy Page. I think one of the first posts we had on this was sometime in 2009, I may be wrong, it could be 2008, it'd be one of the Balkan reports about the anarchists, it was 2009, I think, anarchists saying this global recession and the problems, the austerity that's going to be imposed on Greece or the like gives us the opportunity to shake the system and perhaps topple the system. In other words, they're resurrecting rhetoric from anarchist rhetoric from the 1850s, 1860s, 1870s. They're going to destroy everything in order to build a more just society. But these guys shoot. They have bombs. They have street power. And now they're aligned. They were always sort of aligned, but they're directly aligned with unions in Greece, many of them closely tied to the, interestingly enough, to the socialist government that's imposing austerity, which says we're not going to accept it. You're going to have to continue to pay us, or we're going to stall the economy. It's essentially an economic embargo by the anarchists and the unions, and if necessary, we're going to fight you in the streets. So there's a component there of when Jim says this is the corruption is the igniter of wars in the 21st century, it's a component that is an igniter here of a potentially a civil war. I don't see it going that far now, but you do see those components. And in
but Greece is a case of, you know, we have met the enemy and they are us. Who are they rebelling against?
But Jim, that applies to
thieves against thieves
in sub-Saharan Africa and throughout Asia. The enemy, the same thing, the enemy is us. Greece just is in a peculiar situation where it has the outside support of reasonably honest and very advanced economies in Germany and France. The other places in the Middle East, Central Asia, sub-Saharan Africa, talking about, they don't have that outside structuring support. So they do fall into anarchy and civil war. And as you said a few minutes ago, Jim, the driver is economic interest.
Yeah, but the problem with what happened in Greece is something that's been increasingly common since the Industrial Revolution. It started happening in the 19th century in democracies, in South America, actually, where politicians found there was all this money to play with, and they would get elected if they promised to give a lot of it away. And South America, I think Uruguay or Paraguay, one of them, was the first country to go bankrupt, because the politicians had basically promised more than they could find, as it were. They could obtain in taxes or bribes or what have you. And that's exactly what happened in Europe. It's what a lot of the Americans believe is happening in the United States, where the politicians are basically constantly getting themselves elected by promising to basically give their supporters more goodies. But increasingly they find that they can borrow money, or tax to get the money, and it cripples the economy. That's what happened in Argentina. Argentina was one of the most dynamic and prosperous economies in the world a century ago, but because of, you know, decade after decade of that, hey, politicians, taxing and borrowing more and more money, they crippled the economy, and it's basically a shadow of what it was, you know, comparatively, a century ago. So this keeps happening again and again, and people are only now coming to accept, first to realize, and then to accept that this is something that does not work. Now, those people rioting in Greece, a lot of them understand it works, but, you know, what's the alternative? They figure if they yell loud enough, maybe there'd be a miracle. You know, it's like believing in the Deus ex machina, you know, a miracle from somewhere will come down and make it all better. But, you know, that doesn't happen. As one wag observed, there's no free lunch. Eventually, the bill is going to be presented.
Right. We see the same sort of corruption in Gaza and the West Bank and Lebanon, too, right?
Well, yeah, the Arabs have been, even the Arabs for thousands of years. I mean, the Romans used to complain about this. That's how far back this goes. They would warn their councils, you know, their officials they were sending to the east, to the Middle East. You just got to be careful. Everybody's got their hands in everybody else's pocket or toga, as the case may be, a purse. And that the corruption is a huge problem. It crippled a lot of their legions out there. You know, every Roman who had some power, some clout, found that there was a local willing to do business with him. And the price was your soul, or basically your ability to operate efficiently. And the Turks were appalled by it. I mean, the Turks have a saying which they still apply, don't get yourself involved in the affairs of the Arabs. And they meant that on several levels, but one of them was economic. And, of course, the Arab reform movement, which has been doing quite well in the last two decades, and is even supported by the Saudi royal family. One of their main issues is to deal with the enemy within, basically this corruption. They recognize, there are more and more Arabs are recognizing that, as the old American saying goes from the cartoon, we have met the enemy and they are us. You want to know where the problem is, look in a mirror. And this is a hard thing for a lot of cultures to accept. It's so much easier, and politicians and leaders feed on this, to create an external enemy, to blame it on someone else. No, no, we are too virtuous. We are too good. It couldn't be us that is causing all these problems. It's the colonists. And it's a joke, you know, when the Arabs talk about it, it's the colonial powers, because the Western countries came in after World War I, threw out the Turks, and basically started setting about, you know, not establishing colonies, because even by then, the European countries had realized these colonies are a money pit. You know, you don't get rich with colonies anymore. So basically set them up as independent countries and walk away. But for decades, the Arabs said, no, it's the European colonists or the Crusaders. You know, let's go back 1,000 or more years and find a cause for our current problems. But this has always been false, and now a lot of people are in the countries involved are agreeing. But how do you cope with it? Because the problem is right at home. How do you find, you know, a local? That's why so many people in these countries just want to get out. You know, and they'll complain. They say, yeah, I miss the old country, but there's a lot of things I don't miss. And I hear that again and again.
Right. I think we could, you know, go back to Roman times, too, and look at when they switched from a republic to a empire, that a lot of that was caused by corruption.
And basically, the collapse of the republic was all about the inability to deal with the corruption. Because
right.
A lot of the civil war, and there was actually a series of civil wars and civil conflicts going on, you know, before the empire basically collapsed around, what was it, 30-40 BC. And it was all about trying to deal with the corruption. And eventually the corruption won.
Yeah.
What happened to the empire?
Sometimes I feel like
the republic.
Sometimes I feel like our little catchphrase for Strategy Page should be, it's all happened before, it'll all happen again. So.
Yeah, didn't they use that in some science fiction?
Yeah, it was in Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, there you go. Well, you know, what goes around comes around, and then the past is the prologue to the future. Yes, and it's so true. And especially if you understand the past, I mean, things are not going to, you know, there's no longer a Roman Republic and what have you. But the same general problems that afflicted the Republic are still present to this day in many countries. You know, how do you govern, you know, more than a city-state as a democracy? Many countries, again, the tribalism. Every city in Rome, every city-state, you know, the city and its agricultural environs, suburbs, as it were, see themselves as, you know, people connected by some common, you know, culture and what have you. But every other city sees itself the same way. And they see anyone who's not from Naples or Capua or Rome or, you know, in northern cities in northern Italy, which were partly Gaelic, they don't really see the others as part of us. And that's an ancient problem. We're talking about something that goes back thousands of years. Now, in the United States, we have this e pluribus unum, and we have Europe, where they for decades, multiculturalism was worshipped. And a lot of Americans said, no, that doesn't work. You know, please trust us. We know. But the Europeans only recently have basically come out and said, we're talking about heads of state, saying multiculturalism doesn't work. I mean, Merkel said it, Sarkozy said it, I think the British politicians have said it. Of course, now how do you undo the troubles you created over the last few decades? But at least people are recognizing the problem.
Yeah.
And as I think it's Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, there's a 12-step program for dysfunctional government.
Right.
You know, just look at Alcoholics Anonymous for the pattern, the solution. And it was the 12 steps, right? And I think what is the first one? You got to recognize you got a problem. So we're on one of 12 steps to a solution.
Austin, do you have any closing comments?
Yeah, I'll add this. Look, one of the outs, and you hear this here in the United States all the time too, is everybody does it. And I'm not going to bring up any names, but within the last 3 weeks, I've heard everybody does it as an excuse for governmental members of the government, leaders, elected leaders, for behavior. I'm not just talking about, I'm not talking opaquely about personal behavior, but about political behavior. And here's one case, and I'm going to be opaque about it, but this has gotten some traction in the discussion on the Internet. It's based on a new book that just came out about the housing crisis,
right,
perhaps, the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and that book apparently is on the bestseller list. I've read a couple of reviews on it, and it does mention in there a very powerful American politician who got jobs for individuals he knows and was associated with, and also mentioned another way that some of these mortgage institutions were used as a place to park friends of political leaders, or as a way to keep them employed and to make a lot of money in between government jobs. Legal? Probably. The right thing to do? I'd say no. But the excuse given was everybody does it. Now, that is, I'm not speaking slippery slope here, Dan. The thing is, that is an indicator of a kind of lassitude that is, I'm not strictly speaking slippery slope, but it's an indicator of the kind of lassitude that is ultimately is corrupt, that costs you a great deal economically. That occurs here in the United States. I can say that one of the studies that Transparency International did when the first time I came in contact with TI was, I want to say this is more than a decade ago. And one of the reports talked about school bonding in the United States, you know, selling bonds for public schools, public school districts, was one of the things that they had looked at it, and that there were real doubts about how open that part of the scrutiny, that part of the business was, because school districts could favor certain bond brokers, or they were opaque about what they were going to use the bond money for, or the like. And I'm not going to, that's all right now. I remember reading about it, but I was very interested in what Transparency International had to say about corruption in the United States. Those elements, as Jim said, this is a human affliction. Those elements are at play in the United States. What stops it is saying, you know, you really do have a conflict of interest here. Not everybody does it. And the downside of this can be small, you know, right? Could be small. But the potential risk, that they can look at Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, and of course, this kind of self-interest is not the entire story of why those institutions suffered the way they did, but it is a component of it. Those are the ways that that kind of enforcement of legal standards, moral standards, actually has a long-term economic benefit, and it's something that's difficult. Everybody has to relearn it all the time. It's not a perfect solution. Jim talks about the cultural civil society and the cultural components that are go into an enforcement of a cleaner economy. They are there. The fact that we're even talking about it, and the fact that people in the United States continue to talk about, well, gee, we got to clean this up, and we got to clean that up, is indicative of the kind of cultural strength that ultimately, through this process, gives you a better group economic break. It's not just my tribe's in power now, let's pillage. And I'm not trying to talk to, you know, one over the world philosophizing, but those elements ultimately, they're not, if you look at it just in strictly economic terms, they ultimately have a social economic benefit for honesty and being extremely careful about mixed vested interest. How do you teach that to a country like Congo. How do you teach that? How do you model it? And how does Congo do it with, when it's got as the plethora of tribes that it's got, where every one of them says, last time you were in power, you stole from us. Now I'm going to get back at you. So that's, this is a quantity that, that there are, is such a huge problem with the developmental aid programs in places like Congo.
And you got a high note. There is a model for this. All the Western countries went through this. 1,000 years ago, tribes in Europe were a big problem, and tribal loyalty. And the problem is, the big problem is, not that there's a solution, we know there's a solution, but the solution that worked in Europe took centuries to overcome. As recently as the 19th century, France had a huge problem with corruption. They still do to a certain extent, but basically they cleaned a lot of it up within a century. But what a lot of people are now demanding, like in Afghanistan, is that, you know, we'll do it before the end of the year. It's just not going to happen. And to make it happen, even to an extent, you've got to realize what the limitations are and what you can do, and you've got to attack the problem. And so, you know, again, if you want the solution, look at Alcoholics Anonymous.
Right. Well, I think
that's a good way of coming back and giving a very practical practical example of what I meant about the moral and legal components of it. You watch that. You actually you get the big payoff is a wealthier society.
Yeah.
You're foregoing the short run for the long run, and yeah. People have to see it in that way, or they're going to be stuck in the culture of corruption.
Right. Well, we'll end it there, gentlemen, and we will talk to you next time.
Bye, Dan.
Bye.